Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now. President Bush says today he will lead an investigation into what went wrong and why in the federal response to Hurricane Katrina. But the president said now is not the time for finger-pointing, and he did not respond to calls for a 9/11-like commission to look into possible failures. Senator Susan Collins, a Republican of Maine, today reiterated her call for such an investigation. Standing alongside her, Democrat Senator Joseph Lieberman said the government's response created a national crisis.
Governmental failures in preparing for and responding to Hurricane Katrina allowed much more human suffering and property destruction to occur than should have. That is the sad and stunning fact.
For more on the political fallout of Katrina, we're joined now by John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. And John, Congress has just returned. What do these comments tell you about how this topic is going to be handled?
Well, it tells me that this topic is going to turn the congressional agenda upside down. Congress had come back expecting to deal with things like cutting the estate tax and immigration and Social Security reform, which has been stalled. And now you have a completely transformed agenda. We're talking about money to deal with displaced people, to rebuild the port, to rebuild the city, and also these inquiries into figuring out what went wrong, especially because we still remain very concerned about the possibility of more terrorist attacks, and this showed how vulnerable we are.
Well, and we're going to talk more about the human side of Katrina, as we have been every day since the hurricane, later in the program. But one of the things we're seeing are people relocating, moving across state lines, some coming from New Orleans up here to Massachusetts, where we are. We'll speak about that in a moment. But just give us a sense of what this means that Congress has to deal with now, some of the items that are now on their agenda.
Well, they have to deal with things like waiving eligibility requirements for various governmental benefits, residency requirements. They're going to take that up. They're going to deal with energy legislation. Conservatives are saying this strengthens the argument for relaxing some environmental rules. The Bush administration has suspended some of those temporarily, but the Republican majority wants to make some of those waivers a more permanent and long-lasting thing. We're talking about a lot of money for reconstruction. Some people are talking about government compensatory payments for people who suffered as a result of the slow federal response. We're just going to have to see over time with how much this becomes a dominant issue. Now, the one thing we do remember is after 9/11, after a while, things got back to normal somewhat quicker than many of us expected. So, you know, maybe a month from now, we'll find that the congressional agenda looks more like the old agenda than we expect.
We understand, too, there's going to be back-to-back energy hearings this week as well. You mentioned talk about energy. But perhaps some questions raised about what major oil companies are doing with all of the resources they're accumulating, I read in your Wall Street Journal.
Well, look, the shock to gas prices, which were already high, which were already generating a lot of anxiety about people's current situation and the economic future, are going to be front and center. And you're seeing Republicans, normally the free market party, raising the questions of exactly what are oil companies doing with the surge of revenue they've received, and looking at how quickly prices went up and how much they went up after Katrina. When you've got Republicans looking at questions like those, and the president himself has said we're going to be tough on price gouging, that shows a climate that suggests a better time for activism.
Well, and there have been other questions as well, John Harwood. We spoke yesterday about questions about President Bush's FEMA leader, Michael Brown, questions about his resume, which prior to his being appointed in 2003, he was the head of the Arabian Horsemen's Association. What are all of these questions meaning for President Bush?
Well, first of all, it is likely to deepen the public sense that things are going in the wrong direction in the country. This has been the overhang of the entire year, generated by, among other things, the Iraq War and people's anxiety about that. Sort of surprising, the first blush reaction in some of the opinion polls, people haven't blame the president personally as much as some of the commentary on television might have led you to believe. You had a pretty polarized reaction, with Democrats being sharply critical, Republicans very supportive, and an independent split. Now, we'll see if that holds up over time. It's a pretty tough week for the administration, having sent its people out in news conferences saying we're doing all we can, when you had on the television screens behind them the images of people suffering in New Orleans.
So, that they didn't know about.
Exactly. They said they didn't know till Thursday, when they watched on CNN the fact that people were suffering at the New Orleans Convention Center. So there are a lot of questions to answer. I think we can expect that the president, who had record low approval ratings even before this happened, may go down a bit more. We don't know how much.
And yet, he is still reacting. And as you said, polls are not yet showing any more dissatisfaction. John Harwood, national political editor for the Wall Street Journal, speaking to us from Washington. John, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Well, now we're going to shift our gaze for a moment to China. For the last 6 years, NPR listeners have heard the voice of Rob Gifford reporting from there, his stories about his road trips across the country, his conversations with Chinese peasants, internet CEOs, and prostitutes have introduced listeners to the people behind China's transformation. We spoke with Rob as he was packing his bags and getting ready for his new assignment as NPR's London bureau chief, and we asked him then, after 6 years, to give us a sense of some of the changes he's seen.
Well, China is changing probably faster than any other country on the planet, I think. I wonder if there's ever been a society that has changed this fast. So in 6 years of being here, I really have seen a huge transformation. The cities, mainly. It should be said, it is an urban transformation. The countryside is also changing, but the number of cars on the streets of Beijing has doubled in, I think, the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
The infrastructure is improving. The roads are getting better. The internet is transforming China. The information that's coming in. These are just hardware things. There are also software things. People's thinking, I think, is changing. The internet is helping that. So we are witnessing the opening of China to the outside world, and I think we shouldn't underestimate what a massive change that's having, not only on the hardware and the infrastructure, but on the way people are thinking.
You know, and here in the States, China is usually treated as a business story. We hear about the rise of the manufacturing sector, the growing appetite for oil. We spoke about cars recently, as you just did. But again, you report on the people, and we get so much more because you do that. Let's listen to an example. There was a recent piece from this past July that you did about two men in a rural area who ran for local government and they were beaten. You spoke of their disillusionment and the predicament of China's rural poor. Let's listen.
Zheng is tall and thin. He wears no shirt and has a voice that could strip paint. Once he starts, it's almost impossible to stop him in his anger about how the ordinary people in rural China are being mistreated. For Americans, the three words that sum up so much of what the United States is about are the first three words of the Constitution, we the people. We the people do ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States. For all the complex and sometimes messy nature of democracy, the power is in the hands of the people. China has its own equivalent of we the people, and you hear it every day. Woman Lao Bai Xing, they say. We the ordinary people. But Woman Lao Bai Xing is never followed by grandiose statements of individual empowerment. Woman Lao Bai Xing for Zheng Xiaojun, as for most individuals in rural China, is usually followed by a lament of helplessness. I think this is a very important piece to have listened to. This is the second part, really, of what I want to say, is that, yes, China really is changing, and on the surface, it really is changing. But underneath, there is still a long way to go. There's a huge inertia, especially politically, which is not necessarily being dragged into the 21st century by all the fast cars and the internet connections. And in some areas, you know, we're witnessing the Industrial Revolution here. The Industrial Revolution took place in the West in the 19th century. That's over 100 years ago. In some places, that is happening here. So you've got to really get into the mindset of a peasant, someone who, if the sun doesn't shine and the rain doesn't fall, doesn't have anything to eat.
I guess it feels as if you have these intense moments, these interactions with people that are, you know, they, I don't know, maybe because they haven't been, if you'll forgive me, Oprah-eyes.
I think that's true. Yeah. China is a very raw country. It's just emerging from this cocoon, and it's being bombarded with all of this sort of outside stuff. But at its root, it's still a very rough-edged society, living in the light of an imperial legacy and a communist legacy that, frankly speaking, was very, very brutal and still can be very brutal today. Let's not pretend that a few internet connections and some fast roads are going to change Chinese politics, which is, yes, frankly, very brutal indeed.
There are other modern influences. I'm thinking of some of your wackier stories, which we so loved. One about Chinese people undergoing cosmetic surgery to make them taller. This was from last December. Now, you might have had the same attitude standing next to anyone explaining why they were going to have plastic surgery, but in this case, this gentleman was making historical comparisons. Let's listen.
The operation he's about to undergo has cost him $6,000, but he says it's worth every penny and will certainly boost his career. As well as his interest in movies, Peter Wu is also something of an amateur historian. He has an intriguing take on how history might have been different if this operation had been available to two of history's most famous short men.
Because he was so short, Napoleon had an inferiority complex. He didn't need to attack Russia, but because he was so short, he felt he had something to prove. Hitler was the same. If they weren't so short, they'd probably have become painters or something else.
China in the early 21st century consistently provides the foreign reporter with his fair share of surreal moments. But being lectured on 19th century European history by a short Chinese man about to have his legs voluntarily sawn in half has to rank right up there.
We're listening to Rob Gifford from a report from last December for NPR. And you're not afraid to help us understand a story by giving us your reactions to it.
Well, this is, I think, always the difficulty in reporting generally is of course, you're not supposed to put yourself in the story. I'm just supposed to be an observer. But, you know, I'm also, of course, a human being, and I do see things and hear things and discuss things with Chinese people that move me or make me laugh or cry or whatever. And I don't know. I mean, there's sometimes the stories, you know, very brutal stories where I'm just, telling this with a straight face that someone has been beaten to death in a prison cell. Well, frankly speaking, that's a brutal thing to happen. So sometimes I think personal emotions do get into stories.
That's NPR's Rob Gifford. We spoke to him recently as he was getting ready to move to London for his new posting. Our conversation with Rob about China will continue. But also later in the program, we're going to check in on Mississippi post-Katrina. And we'll hear more about those 2,000 evacuees who are heading from the Gulf region to Massachusetts. There's more coming up here and now. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation with Rob Gifford, NPR's man in China for the past 6 years. We spoke with Rob as he was getting ready to leave his base in Beijing for London. Now, one of his pieces from China that many listeners may remember was from his road trip across the country last year. He found himself in a small church where the pastor hadn't shown up. Let's listen to an excerpt, and then we'll continue our conversation with Rob Gifford.
The service was supposed to start at 10:30, and the pastor is not here.
他应该是十点半到，是吗？啊，十点半就上礼拜了。Okay,
so the people in the church are sitting waiting for the service, and they've asked me if I will preach the sermon. This is not something I was expecting when I arrived. I'm trying to explain that this isn't really something I'm used to doing. I don't think I'm going to be allowed to leave unless I preach a sermon. Not a situation I've ever been in before. Okay, where's my Bible?
The assumption in Chinese churches is that all Westerners are Christians. They didn't even ask me whether I believed in God or not. But I felt I couldn't just creep away without, in some meager way, trying to help them out. So, with Bible in one hand and tape recorder in the other, a very basic sermon is preached.
So there you are, Rob Gifford, preaching to the Chinese. What did you say?
I should confess my interest, or should I say my beliefs here. I do actually have religious beliefs. I am a Christian, and I'm certainly not a preacher, but I think that made it certainly a little bit easier, in that when I was thrust into the situation, I was able to sort of dig something up from my mind. I think I can preach Christianity 101 fairly okay.
Which part did you choose?
I actually chose one of the best-known verses from the New Testament, John chapter 14, verse 6. Jesus said, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." So I had to think faster to say something, and I had a Chinese Bible in my hand, and I just, that was the verse that came into my head. As I say, I'm not a preacher. Don't invite me to preach in your church,
but,
please.
But I wonder, how much did your being a Christian affect your reporting or your view of China with its new face of a religion?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think, of course, it informs who I am. It informs what I do in my life and how I live my life. But it influences what I'm interested in China. I'm very interested in what Chinese people believe. I think, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of what the Chinese story is about is economics. People, and myself included, we talk about the economy and where's China going and how fast is China growing. I'm interested in what are Chinese people believing? Because that's a whole different animal altogether. I mean, does anybody know what the Chinese people are believing? They don't believe in Chairman Mao anymore. They don't believe in communism. Do they believe in Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism like in the old days? Well, some of that is coming back as well. But I think one of the amazing things about China now is you have this sort of blank sheet of paper, spiritually speaking, and people are groping around to try and find out what on earth life is all about. They don't have a fixed religious, spiritual mindset.
Rob Gifford speaking to us from Beijing, where he's been reporting for NPR. Rob, you arrived in China with a wife. You're leaving with a wife and two children, moving to London to be bureau chief, going to take some time off to write a book. When you find yourself wondering now what Chinese believe in, do you have a sense of what in 5 years they might have found?
I think it's like any country, it's a very mixed bag. I think they are becoming more prosperous. And of course, the cliche is that all the Chinese people believe in now is money. There is a lot of truth in that, I have to say. There is a lot of just, you know, straight out money grabbing, you know, go for all you can to get as much as you can. And, you know, that can look quite ugly sometimes when you're looking at it from the outside, but we shouldn't really, I don't think we're really in a position to criticize the Chinese. They've been deprived of any kind of material well-being for most of the last 5,000 years, so now they've got the chance to make some. You know, I think some of that is very understandable. I think we have just seen this great explosion over the last 20 years of everything in China in terms of economic development and social development and the changes in people's minds. And I think we're seeing a sort of maturing now of Chinese society. In the next 5-10 years, we'll definitely see that as things kind of settle a little bit, and the dust and the frantic nature of the last 20 years may just calm down just a little.
You had compared the Chinese people to Red Sox fans. I know you went to Harvard. Can you just give us what is your thought on that?
That was a bit of a throwaway. I'm just thinking about this whole comparison. The living in China, the Chinese have a real sort of victim mentality. They're always the losers. They're always being beaten up and bullied by the big Western powers over the last 150 years. And how are they going to move out of that? It's the thing of the World Series from last summer. You know, everyone was saying, oh my goodness, the Red Sox have won the World Series. Well, but the defining feature of being a Red Sox fan is that, I don't want to say this, but that you're a loser.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
It's just, you've gone through so many decades of this. So what happens when you're finally a winner? How, what's your identity? And I have to say, that is something about what China is now. Suddenly, China, for the first time in a long, long time, is a winner. It's not being bullied by other people. It's standing up, and it's got some clout, and it's got some influence in the world. So I guess that's what I was saying. It's maybe stretching a little bit, but perhaps the Red Sox fans will forgive me the comparison.
And understand it completely. Rob Gifford, reporting from Beijing, China, for one of the last times. We really appreciate it, and we look forward to hearing what you're going to do next. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Robin.
We just felt attention had to be paid. So for links to some of Rob's reporting, go to our website, here-now.org. And just ahead, we'll shift our gaze back to where it's been for the last week and a half. We'll check in on Mississippi and the airlifting of evacuees to Massachusetts in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes Here and Now. The larger spotlight in the wake of Hurricane Katrina has been on New Orleans, but the Mississippi coast was also devastated. The death toll there is rising. Hundreds of thousands of people remain without power, and damage estimates continue to climb, all in one of the poorest states in the nation. Jerry Mitchell is a reporter for the Jackson Clarion Ledger, the statewide paper in Mississippi. Jerry, just how bad is it there?
Well, frankly, Mississippi's devastated, particularly the Gulf Coast region. The governor said the other day that it looked like the Gulf Coast region, really from border to border, had just been swept with a broom. I mean, we have cities like Waveland that have literally just been destroyed, just wiped off the map.
Well, and so far the death toll has been put at 170.
That's the official death toll, yeah.
And what's the thinking?
Well, some people who've been involved in the search and rescue, think that it could top 1,000, which is really scary. But frankly, there's so many areas that they haven't gone into, and so much debris that they haven't gone through. That's a real possibility. I know that an official from the city of Biloxi said they probably have several hundred dead there. They're keeping the dead. Kind of gruesome, but they're keeping the dead in these refrigerated trucks. They're kind of like makeshift morgues that they have down the coast.
What are some of the other problems Mississippians are facing?
There's tremendous problems. I mean, the Gulf Coast will probably take years to rebuild. They've lost their infrastructure, no power, no water, everything gone. And then other parts of Mississippi have been hard hit as well. Jones County, which is about an hour and a half south of Jackson, they had, I think, 1,000. There were like 1,000 homes that were hit by trees. And 12 people died in that county, which is a fairly small county. It's not a big populated county at all.
We understand there's gas rationing?
Yes, quite a bit. On the coast, you can hardly get it. Mm-hmm. In Poplarville, where the President Bush spoke yesterday, there were literally people standing in line. I'm talking about driving up to the gas station. I'm talking about walking up to the gas station with little gas cans, because that's all they were going to be able to give them.
Right.
They were rationing it to that effect.
You spoke of President Bush's visit. He said, Mississippi is on my mind, and that drew a lot of applause from the 200 business leaders from the community who were in the audience. But what are you hearing? How are people in general speaking of the government response?
It's split. I mean, some people think this is a disaster that nobody could have foreseen, and then others think that, that frankly, the state and federal officials just responded too slowly to this, and then perhaps more people could have been saved if they'd come in quicker.
Your governor, Haley Barbour, is one who feels that the national media is being, you know, too critical.
Right.
But you quote an interesting thought from Senator Trent Lott, who you say, well, how has he responded to the help?
Well, he said that he felt like perhaps the federal help had come too slowly, but, you know, that basically you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. They're going to be relying, of course, on the federal government to come in and supply these funds, already supplying $10.5 billion for the area.
We've been hearing a lot about the importance of restoring New Orleans and the character of New Orleans. What are people in Mississippi saying about restoring their part of the coast? What's the importance?
Well, a lot of the landmarks have been taken out, including like Beauvoir, which is the home of Jefferson Davis, which is kind of a historic landmark, and a lot of other historic landmarks have been taken out. So there's a real strong feeling among Mississippians, I think, that they want to go back and rebuild these things. They don't. I know that Mary Mahoney's, which is a real famous restaurant to Mississippians down on the Gulf Coast, they spray painted on their wall, "We'll be back," you know. So I think that's the feeling of a lot of Mississippians, that we're going to rebuild and be back.
Mississippi, not a wealthy state.
And that's part of the problem, you know.
Well, any sense of where the money's going to come from?
I mean, it's going to have to come from the federal government, I mean, because Mississippi doesn't have the money. I mean, in fact, the state has a $400 million deficit it's facing this year. So I can't imagine the state has any kind of extra money at all. And then I've kind of bled all the other resources because of these deficits that we've had over the recent years.
Jerry Mitchell with the Clarion Ledger in Mississippi. Jerry, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, in New Orleans, engineers are beginning to pump the floodwater out of the city, and officials are stepping up efforts to evacuate the estimated 10,000 people who have not left yet. The mayor now saying water will no longer be handed out to people who refuse to leave. Republican Congressman Jerry Dindle of Louisiana told New Orleans TV station WWL-TV that federal officials need to do a better job of keeping flood victims informed on what their immediate future is.
People are reasonable. They don't expect you to solve all their problems overnight, but they want you to have a plan. Tell them when they're going to get a shower. Tell them when they're going to get clothes. When are their kids going to go to school? Give them a timeline that they can believe in that's credible.
That's Congressman Bobby Jindal. I think I said Jerry. Our last reporter was Jerry. Well, many Americans, and in fact, many states, are stepping up with offers to help and house evacuees. Several thousand displaced hurricane victims are making their way here to Massachusetts, where we are, and they will be housed at a military base on Cape Cod. This morning, Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney told Boston's WBUR it's an enormous challenge.
We have no idea who's coming. Are they aged? Do they need mental health support? We've had to prepare for any contingency, including Department of Corrections contingency. We may have people that are coming here from prisons. We may have people coming instead from something like a hospice. When you know so little about the population coming, you have to be prepared to do anything that might be required.
Well, joining us on the line now, reporter Fred Tice, covering the story from Cape Cod. Hi, Fred.
Hey, Robin.
And Audie Cornish, reporting from the Massachusetts State House. Audie, let's start with you. Who is coming? Do we know any more about the evacuees headed this way?
Well, as the governor says, no, we do not. And as a result, the $25 million the legislature is freeing up in emergency funds to help these evacuees is not slated for anything in particular. It's open funds that's going to be made available to the teams working at Camp Edwards down on Cape Cod, and that will be the focal point for bringing in evacuees. But again, no word yet on what state they're coming from or what kind of population it is.
So we don't know if they will need schools for kids or guards for prisoners. Fred, who's bringing the evacuees?
Well, the Federal Emergency Management Administration is managing all this. Back on Saturday, they had a conference call with all 50 states where they assigned each state a number of refugees or a number of tasks, and Massachusetts was assigned with receiving 2,500 refugees coming up from Texas.
And where are they going to stay?
They are going to stay at Camp Edwards, which is an Army National Guard base here on Cape Cod. They are going to be staying in barracks. There are going to be four people to a room, two bunk beds in each room, one bathroom on each floor. These are three-story cinder block and brick buildings, normally housing Army National Guard soldiers who come down here to train at Cape Cod.
Right. That's a reporter, Fred Tice. He's down on Cape Cod waiting for the evacuees who were said to have left at around noon from the Gulf. They're headed to the Cape Cod area. Audie Cornish is also standing by at the Massachusetts State House, where the governor has been commenting over the course of the morning on what has got to be one of the more unusual experiments in generosity that's come out of Hurricane Katrina, as over 2,000 evacuees make their way from the Gulf Coast area. You are listening to Here and Now as we follow this story. Well, Audie, I want to get back to you. Do we know how long the evacuees will stay? What arrangements are being made?
No, it's very interesting, the tack that the governor is taking. First and foremost, he's brought in all kinds of interfaith, church, synagogue, Islamic leaders, faith-based groups, particularly black church leaders, to be very much involved in the process, which means that they'll be going to the base, helping process people, doing spiritual counseling, and reaching out to the evacuees that are there. He's also having the same group of people help select a quote-unquote mayor. He's calling it a humanitarian in chief. But he's also saying this person is a sort of ombudsman. This is someone who's going to be on the base working with the rescue and relief effort teams there and working with the state as liaison to really just keep an eye on things and make sure that these evacuees are taken care of and their needs are taken care of, and to keep an eye on what's going on with the state efforts as well.
And Fred, down on Cape Cod, Massachusetts Governor, again, Mitt Romney, called on residents to volunteer in week-long shifts. They're not quite sure what they're volunteering for, but maybe to serve food or, you know, help take care of kids. That's a major commitment. What is your sense down there of how Cape Cod is receiving these evacuees?
Well, difficult to say how the people are receiving it yet. One of the towns here, Bourne, on which the base sits, has undertaken to educate the children. It remains to be seen what age groups the children are. If they're all elementary school kids, they're going to open up a base school here for them. If they're of all ages, they'll be integrated into the local town school district. There are signs outside of the base that say volunteers sign up here, but so far I didn't see any volunteers showing up. And they'll be volunteering, as you said, for 5-day periods for anything from taking care of pets to providing psychological counseling to making meals.
We understand.
For the evacuees.
Yeah, we understand. Kids are making signs, you know, to hold up to welcome them. There's a way you have to sort of enter the Cape Cod area through a rotary, and there's going to be signs there welcoming them. Audie, just want to check with you with one last thought. Otis Air National Guard Base, where they're going, is perhaps ironically one of the military bases that's just been slated for closure. Is that going to impact this at all?
I'm not sure if it will, but I know the governor is preparing for the potential resettlement of these people, not considering them just a transient population. He's asking church communities around the state to adopt a family to help them find jobs and homes. He says that the state has opened its doors for 2,500 evacuees for the next 60 days, but he's fully aware that he may have to open Medicaid rolls to help pay for people who need hospice or other care, also opening up more funding further down the line for people who may decide to make their homes in Massachusetts. And he says he's hoping that federal emergency officials will do some reimbursement for that, though he's very much aware that that may not happen in the long term.
That's Here Now reporter Audie Cornish. We've also been hearing from Fred Tice down in Cape Cod, both of them following the evacuees heading from the Gulf for the Massachusetts area. Both of you, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, individuals are also stepping up, offering their homes to evacuees. One mother from the bucolic Boston suburb of Sudbury was so intent on doing that she crashed Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney's press conference on Sunday after failing to get a response from several aid agencies. And briefly, Linda Murray joins us. Linda, what did you do?
I heard him live on the radio. I was in the area, so I kind of drove up to the back of the state police barracks in Framingham. It was all blocked off by cyclone fencing. And I scaled the fence and ran as fast as I could up to where he was, and I couldn't get to speak with him.
I mean, you're lucky you didn't get tackled.
That's what I was thinking afterwards.
Well, what possessed you? I mean, what was it that drove you this far?
I was just hitting dead ends, and I just wanted to help out, and I couldn't help out financially, but I wanted to tell them I could take on a family in my home.
Now there are all sorts of websites and all sorts of different agencies that are trying to put people together. Are you involved in that?
Well, I do believe as of today there will be a 1-800 number.
Here in Massachusetts?
Yes.
Well, listen, good luck to you.
Okay.
That's Linda Marie of Sudbury, Massachusetts, reflecting the feelings of a lot of Americans who just wanted to do something. Of course, she crashed a press conference. When we come back, we're going to meet some people who did open their homes and have had a wonderful success welcoming evacuees. And also this reminder for that 800 number here in the Massachusetts area and for websites across the country, you can go to ours, here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Now, thousands of Americans have opened their homes and their hearts to evacuees from the Gulf. Several private groups have started up websites to connect people in need of housing with people who want to help out. 20-year-old Jessica DeNicola of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and her husband have been hosting two people from New Orleans since Friday night. After connecting with them through one of those websites, hurricanehousing.org, and she joins us now on the line. Jessica, why did you want to do this?
I wanted to do something, and, like, I went to the shelters and volunteered, and it just felt like it wasn't enough.
Well, who do you have staying?
I have a girl named Vera and her boyfriend named Scott, and they are from New Orleans.
How's it working out?
It's working out great. We actually sat down and talked last night because they would come in the afternoon, and they would go straight into the bedroom and go to sleep, and I told her, you know, I wanted to get to know them. I didn't know anything about them, didn't know their story, anything, and, she wrote me a letter back telling me that she felt like she was imposing and didn't want to put us out in any way and that it was just a complete misunderstanding. So we sat down last night and we barbecued and got to know each other better.
Were you at all worried before you did this, Jessica? You're 20 years old and, you know, you weren't guaranteed you'd get a lovely couple.
Yeah, I was. I was hesitant to let them come and, me and my husband were going to let him stay for that night and then, you know, help him find somewhere else to stay. But we met him and hit it off really good. So we decided, you know, as long as they need a place to stay, our house is open to them.
Really? That could be, you have a small house, two bedroom. That could be a long time, months.
Right.
You're sure about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Jessica DeNicola, what would you say to people who are interested in doing this?
I would just say follow your gut instinct, and if you're hesitant about it, definitely don't do it. I mean, you're putting your life in someone else's hands pretty much, and, you know, I mean, if you have the feeling that it's something you want to do, then research it some more and see if there is somebody out there that you can help.
That's Jessica DeNicola of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Now, her house guests, Vera Lester and Scott Andrews, have been volunteering with the Red Cross every day in Baton Rouge while they look for jobs. We reached Vera on her cell phone, and she told us earlier that she's not sure when she'll be able to return home to New Orleans, but she has been inspired by the generosity of her host.
She's a really special girl, and actually the first couple of days, my boyfriend and I, who are staying with her, We really were trying to stay out of their hair and to stay scarce as much as possible because it's not the biggest place. And, you know, we didn't want to impose any more than we were already. And she wrote me this incredible letter because she was worried that maybe she had done something to hurt our feelings. And that she really is, she hasn't just opened her home to us, but she really wants to support us as much as possible. I can't, in a lot of ways, I can't imagine. It's an incredible thing that she's done for us, and it surprises me and encourages me about human people, but it also is very typical of people in this area, and it's part of the reason that it's so important to me to stay and to not leave and to not abandon the area, even though we've had such a disaster.
That's Vera Lester. She and her boyfriend Scott Andrews are among the estimated 1 million people left homeless by Hurricane Katrina. Well, the entire city of Lake Providence, Louisiana, has come together to help people who lost their homes in Katrina. Now, it is a small farming community of 6,000 people who are now hosting hundreds of evacuees. Reverend Don Boyett is heading efforts at the Providence Church. Reverend, how many people do you think you've helped?
We have had well over 200 in the shelter. Close to around 250 probably have been there in the church. Now, at one time, probably 150 at one time. I just wish that you could be here to see how many people, churches, total community effort. Amazing. You know, these small river towns, They seem to do that in times of crisis. We may fight each other in the good times, but boy, when the bad comes, we join our hearts together.
Well, why Providence?
You know, we're on Highway 65, which is a thoroughfare, a federal highway that goes from New Orleans to North Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So when they are we're on an evacuation route, mm-hmm. and so when they head north, they come through here. We did the same thing when Ivan came through, but Ivan was not nearly as destructive, so the people were not nearly as desperate. When these people came, they had no money. They had nothing. They came mostly with the clothes on their back. They threw things as much as they could into their cars. Some have lost their pets. They couldn't bring them. Some did bring their pets. We've got birds and cats and dogs in the church, and we're all doing pretty well together. Even the pets are.
Can you describe the church for us? What through the church building do you provide the people? And what are they eating?
We have what we call gymnatorium, big room with classrooms all around the sides, upstairs and downstairs. So it made a perfect setting for housing these people. And what we're feeding them, oh, my, Southern cuisine. Churches, different churches are feeding each night. We have businesses who've been feeding. Gosh, you've just got, fried chicken, a grilled chicken, barbecue of all kinds, and, of course, just an abundance of sandwiches that they can eat all through the day, potato salad, beans, and cornbread, and, if you can think of Southern food, we've had it.
Well, how are you doing that, Reverend Boyette? Because it sounds like a wonderful town, but not an extremely wealthy town. We know you give these people who are coming through, these evacuees from New Orleans, you're giving them plane, train, bus tickets.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am, that is right.
Where does this money come from?
Well, it's coming from really all over, mainly the community. People, businesses, churches are giving into the relief fund, and we're now trying to find them homes.
Well, Reverend Boyette, you are a reverend. What do you tell them? Why does this happen? What do you say?
We point out very, very quickly that God has nothing to do with this. He's a God of love, and he would never do anything to destroy homes and to destroy lives and disrupt families. This is something that happens. I mean, it's a part of what happens in the earth. And so we tell them this, that God has a wonderful plan and destiny for their lives, according to Jeremiah 29:11. God says, I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for prosperity and a future, not for calamity, but for hope. And so we deal with that. But encouragement, just always smiling, always giving them hope, patting them on the back, giving them a hug. We're a hugging congregation, and the people have just fallen in love with being hugged, being touched, and it just feels good.
Well, I ask because, there are some who are preaching that this has happened to New Orleans because of its lifestyle.
Well, I've heard that, and I'm not going to say that at this time because, our city has problems that we've dealt with before, and every city I know has the element of sin in it. If that's the case, if that were the reason and the only reason, then America should have been wiped out, not just New Orleans. And so I can't say that that's the reason. At least at this point, I'm just saying that God has a wonderful plan. And so that's what we're preaching.
Don Boyette is the reverend at the Providence Church in Lake Providence, Louisiana, north of New Orleans. They've taken in a few hundred evacuees who are still with them and probably will be for the foreseeable future. Reverend Boyette, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.